This episode is brought to you by Café Patachou, a student union for adults since 1989 in the heart of Indianapolis.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Black culture through the complicated lens of agriculture. We speak to Carla Hall about her uncompromising soul food recipes.
And I was like, what am I doing? Why am I changing my family's history for another culture?
We also hear from Gabriela Rodriguez at Harlem Grown's Youth Farm Uptown.
About empowerment and, you know, community resilience building through this work. Food is kind of just a vehicle.
Leah Penniman addresses feeling like an outsider in the farming community.
I could count on my two hands the number of people who appeared to be POC, people of color. And so I literally would go around little slips of paper and say, hey, meet at 1 o'clock under this tree so we can talk.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts. All right. Hello. This is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Today, I'm here with Bob Quinn, an organic grain farmer from Montana and the author of the new book, Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa. It's great to be here.
Congrats on the book release, first of all.
Thank you very much.
So I'm really excited to have you here for a few reasons. First of all, we were talking a little bit before, but it's very rare for me to have farmers from the West actually in studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Well, it's not exactly across town for me either. So
right. You came, I think you said 3,000 miles?
Well, at least over two.
Okay. and, you know, you're on your book tour, so you've got, I'm sure you've got lots of interviews, but I'm excited that you're here with us today. And you have decades and decades of farming experience. And, you know, I was really struck by the name of your book because right in the title, it starts to make connections between agriculture practices, rural economies, health. And I think the way in which those things overlap is really important and doesn't get talked about that often.
I agree.
Yeah. So before we dive into all of that, let's just give listeners a little bit of background. So you grew up on a farm in Montana, is that correct?
Yes, it's our family farm. My grandfather started in 1920, so next year will be our 100th anniversary.
Wow. Okay. And you weren't always there. You left, you got a PhD, you came back. Did you always want to be a farmer?
Actually, I always wanted to work with plants, and I love science, and I thought, well, I'll just keep going to school as long as they pay me. I was very fortunate to get the scholarships, and I just kept going year after year, and all of a sudden 10 years had gone by, and I had a PhD, And I found that academia really wasn't quite what I expected, and the pursuit of science was a little bit obscured sometimes by kingdom building and just the seeking of grants and the scrambling for money. And rather than a cooperative effort to really push out the quest for knowledge.
Right. So you thought you could do that on a farm.
Well, I decided to go back to the farm because it's what I knew. And soon after I got there, my whole farm became my laboratory and my garden.
Mm. And so in the beginning, you weren't farming organically, right?
Right. We were raised on a conventional farm. My dad was one of the first to adopt the use of herbicides in the early 50s and then experimented with chemical fertilizers soon after that. He was always innovating and on the cutting edge of what was new and exciting, and that's how we look at it in those days. It was new and exciting.
Right.
And for him, who grew up at a time without herbicides, the problems with weeds was real.
I mean,
they didn't do rotations. They didn't do anything to decrease that problem, so it became worse and worse. So they looked at herbicides as sort of a godsend, and no one really questioned started to question the long-term effects or any of that sort of thing when we first were introduced to them.
Right. And so what made you start to question it and kind of make that decision to transition the farm to organic?
Well, I had the opportunity. I started a small business to sell our grain directly to whole grain bakers in Southern California because we had come back to a farm that was big enough for one family but not quite big enough for two. And my parents were still there. My dad wasn't quite retirement age, so we farmed together for nearly 10 years. And I was looking for something to add more value to the farm. And once I did that, our customer in California, after the first year, asked us for some organic grain. Hmm. And I didn't really believe in organic. I'd heard about it when I was in California going to school at UC Davis, but I wasn't a believer. Mm-hmm. But when I started to, I found some organic grain. And when I started to meet organic farmers and hearing their stories, it really perked my interest. And the idea of growing your own fertilizers to me was very intriguing because of my plant science background. And I thought that was really interesting. And the idea of controlling weeds through non-chemical means also was very intriguing. So I started with very small experiments and I was almost an instant convert.
Yeah.
And after that became a huge promoter.
Right. And so what does your farm look like today? Like, can you give listeners kind of an idea of what you're growing, how big it is?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in Montana, the average farm is about 25 to 2,700 acres. We're out in the eastern part of Montana. Eastern two-thirds of Montana is prairie. So we're in the upper Great Plains or northern Great Plains. Our farm is about 4,000 acres. About 1,000 of that is pasture for cattle because it's not able to be cultivated because of the roughness of the terrain and cattle fits well. We have a 9-year rotation. We grow 4 different types of soil building crops, such as sweet clover, alfalfa, and peas, and buckwheat, and every other year. And we sandwich that between 5 years of cash crops, such as winter wheat, spring wheat, which we're growing Kabut Khorasan wheat and ancient wheat. Mm-hmm. I grow also barleys, Hollis barley and purple barley. We grow Ohio Lake safflower and also some peas and some alfalfa for alfalfa hay for organic dairies. So it's we have a lot of diversity, which keeps the whole thing moving and working properly.
Right. And is it pretty rare where you are in Montana to be organic?
Well, it's less rare than it used to be. When 30 years ago, when I first started, it was extremely rare.
Yeah.
And my friends thought, and neighbors thought I had been in California too long. And they were assured, assured that I would go broke or quit the organic experiment, as they referred to it, within just a few years. But neither of those happened. And now even a few of our neighbors have also converted. And Montana is leading the country in the production of organic wheat.
Huh.
Even though Kansas has this, for conventional wheat, has this growing it by 2 or 3 times. Organic wheat, we lead the country. We also lead the country in organic lentils and some oilseed crops.
Interesting. Is Montana, is the climate like particularly suited to growing wheat?
Yes.
Okay.
It's hot and dry, which wheat loves for ripening and producing high protein. And so the wheat is always under stress. And, you know, if you're under stress, you perform a little better.
Yeah.
It's not too much stress. So it has to be a balance. But the protein that we can produce normally in our part of the state is superior to most other in the country. And therefore, it's performing better in bread. And now I'm focusing just not on protein, but ancient and heirloom varieties, which add flavors and taste to that mix to make a superior product.
Right. So one of those varieties is the Khorasan wheat that you mentioned,
yes,
right?
Uh-huh.
And so that's a big part of what you do, right?
I've been working on that for 30 years.
Yeah.
It's turned into an enormous project, but
right.
A very satisfying one.
I want to walk through that. First of all, a really important question. I don't know if I pronounced the word correctly. So is it Kamut?
Yes.
Okay.
Kamut. We say
Kamut.
Kamut.
See,
yeah.
I didn't.
Well, that was pretty close. That was pretty close.
Okay. So Kamut is kind of the brand name for
that's
the
a brand name,
Khorasan
right.
wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We wanted to have a brand so we could protect the ancient grain. Once we had an inkling of its unique qualities. I wanted to protect that so it just couldn't be put on the market under all kinds of marketing cleverness and it may be mixed with other grains and try to be sold cheap and fool people. So we wanted to preserve it as a pure line. And I really was completely sold on organic by that time, and I wanted to promote organic agriculture. So Kamuda is only available as an organically grown grain.
Interesting. Anywhere.
Anywhere in the whole world. That's that's the rule. So we look at the grain as a free gift from our creator, should be available for anyone to grow. But if they want to use the Kamut trademark, well, that belongs to me.
Got it.
And I get to make the rules since I own it in the first rule. And the first rule is it has to always be organically grown. The second rule, you have to tell the truth about it. So you can't pretend it's not wheat and gluten-free and some of the things that have been done with other ancient grains and other ancient wheats even. So we're very, I'm very big on truth and labeling and not trying to make something more than it is, but just tell the story as it is. It's good enough.
Right. So how did you first discover this particular ancient wheat?
Oh, well, that's how much time we have?
not too long.
Okay, I'll give you the Reader's Digest, the Reader's Digest version. Well, I had first seen it when I was in high school, actually. There's this old fellow, he's probably younger than I am now, but he looked old to me then, and he was passing out this giant wheat at the county fair, and he saw me walking close by, and he says, "Hey, sonny," he says, "why don't you come over here?" He says, "I'll give you some of King Tut's wheat." I said, "Wow, okay." Well, I went over, and he poured a handful out of the can into my hand, and it was giant. It was three times the size of regular wheat. Of course, I was raised in a wheat farm, so I knew what wheat was supposed to look like.
Right.
And I don't know what I ever did with it, but the legend going around at the time was that a fellow from our county had been in a bar one night in Portugal. He was in the Air Force, and the guy sitting next to him started telling him about his travels to Egypt and how he had taken this grain out of a tomb in Egypt, you know, very mysterious, and all kinds of intrigue. And so he gave him about 30 or 40 kernels, and the fellow sent it back to his father in Montana, and it grew, which should have been the first clue it didn't come out of a tomb, you see, because grain doesn't last 4,000 years in a tomb and still be viable. most wheat will last 15 to 20 years before it starts to decline.
Still pretty long.
It's pretty long, but it's not 4,000.
Right.
So anyway, it grew, and it was much taller, as most heritage and old wheats are, before they were bred for shortness. And it was much bigger. That was unusual. And it was turned out to be a very close relative of durum, which meant that it didn't make bread in a traditional way, the American white bread way. This is in the 50s, very easily. Mm. So there was really very little interest in it commercially. And it was spread around as a novelty for about 10 years or so. That's when I saw it, the very kind of end of its novelty period. Mm-hmm. And then it disappeared. And when I was in college at UC Davis, then about 14 years later, so this is about 76 now, I was eating a package of corn nuts one day, just idly passing the time, taking a little break from my laboratory work. And it said on the back of the package, corn nuts made with a giant corn. And I thought, oh, I wonder if they'd be interested in a giant wheat.
Huh.
So I called them up, and they were located in Berkeley, or near Oakland at that time, quite close to Davis. And they said, oh, we might be interested in that. And I called my dad, and I said, "Dad, see if you can find some of that old King Tut's wheat." And within a few days, he found a pint jar about three-quarters full, and he sent me a couple of tablespoons, and they roasted it up. And I said, I called them then another week later, and they said, "Wow, this is the best stuff we've ever had." He says, "We'll take 10,000 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, "Well, I really don't have 10,000 pounds. I didn't tell him I didn't even have 1 pound. But I said, "If you just hang on a year or two, I'll have all you want." And so we started growing it in our garden and in Santa California, and grew it over the winter. And so we multiplied it up to about 50 pounds. And I called back, and the fellow I had talked to was gone. No one had heard of it or was interested, and that was the end of that. Mm. So it sat in our garage for about 5 years until we went to our first food show in California, health food show, because our business of selling grain directly to bakers by that time had grown to include stone ground whole wheat flour.
Okay.
Now we had something to show at a food show. And my mother and father went with me, and my dad took some of this old grain, and he was showing it to everybody. At the end of the show, my cousin and I, who were kind of put this business together, had our pockets just full of referrals. We were thrilled to death. Mm. My dad had one referral, but he was thrilled to death. So we took out all 50 pounds, and we planted a half acre, and that was in 86. And 30 years later, in 16, we planted or had had planted, contracted with about 250 other organic farmers besides ourselves, nearly 100,000 acres.
Wow.
So it surpassed all of our expectations as far as success in the marketplace.
Right. Well, and so you said it, the first thing you noticed about it was so big, right?
Yes.
It was tall. What's the benefit of that? Like what?
Well, that's the novelty part.
Okay.
So that's really not a big benefit. You have to be a little bit careful how you combine it because it's so hard, it's easily cracked. And so the size makes that even more problematic. But what was interesting is not that it was so big, but what was inside.
Okay.
And the most interesting thing when we first started, a pass around pasta had been made with it by a friend in California, just as kind of a demo. We gave it to, or my dad actually gave it to, a lady who had terrible food allergies and she couldn't eat anything close to wheat.
Mm.
And she'd be completely just on the couch. I mean, her muscles would give out their strength and she was incapacitated nearly. I would have never given her this stuff,
right?
But she used to do muscle testing, and she could tell that it might be something she could try. So she tried it, and she called up the next day, and she says, "What is this stuff?" She said, "When I ate it, it made me feel better."
Hmm.
I said, "Wow, never heard anything like that before,"
because yeah.
We knew that she couldn't touch wheat. And they said, "Well, we'll give you some more." And she gave some to her sister who had similar problems, not as severe, but she had many food allergies, and not only including wheat, and not only could she eat this, but after she'd eaten it for a couple of weeks, she was less allergic to other things that had previously affected her.
Huh.
And then the science just in me kind of woke up,
right,
and
right.
said, "Wow, this is really interesting. I wonder what's going on and why it is different." And from then on, my quest, I should have been paying more attention to marketing, but my real quest was to figure out how this was different and what we had done to modern wheat so that so many people couldn't eat it anymore.
Right.
Now it's nearly 20% of the people that can't eat modern wheat. As a wheat farmer, that's embarrassing to me.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. And so I wonder, well, where did we make a wrong turn? Because wheat has built civilizations for tens of thousands of years and been the staff of life, mm-hmm. as it's referred
right.
to. So what has happened in the last 70 years to change all that so that 20% of people can no longer eat it? Something has gone really off the track.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than focus on the problem, I have tried to focus on the solution. And the solution seemed to be right in my hands. But I really wanted to understand it more and
yeah.
say, well, you can eat this, we think, but we don't know why.
Yeah.
I wanted to really have some understanding. So we started on research and to try to figure that out.
You're starting it now?
We've been working on it for 30 years, but we've finally hit pay dirt about 10 or 12 years ago
okay.
with a group in Italy. I had a hard time finding scientists in America that would take me serious and want to work with me because most of them would say, well, wheat's wheat. All wheat has gluten. Your wheat has gluten. It's no different than anybody else's. Mm. And if people are having trouble, it's mostly in their head.
Yeah.
And that was and 30 years ago, that was the attitude with a lot of the people looking at this problem.
Mm.
And it took many years for those people who had trouble to convince people it wasn't in their head. It was more in their stomach
yeah.
and other places in their body that was having adverse reactions. And we found a team in Italy that was willing to work with us at the University of Bologna, which is nearly 1,000 years old, so they've been around a while, and the University of Florence. There we were working with the medical research hospital. And they started studying living systems. Before then, we have just been doing in vitro and chemical analysis and all this sort of thing, and we couldn't really see anything that was significantly different. I mean, it was in the ballpark of modern wheat. You couldn't point to one thing or another and say, well, this is why. But when they started doing research on living systems, starting with an animal study first, a small rat study, we just did one of those, but we published three papers on it. We first discovered that it had a higher antioxidant capacity than modern wheat. And the tests were that we'd feed either one group modern wheat or one group ancient grain. But the big surprise that we didn't expect, and was kind of found serendipitously from a lady that was just observing, and she observed that the rats on the Kamut diet had no inflammation. And they should have had inflammation because they were giving shots of a drug that made free radicals and also caused inflammation. So the diet was protecting them from inflammation.
Hmm.
And about this time, the Wheat Belly book came out, and Dr. Davis said, well, all wheat causes inflammation. So I called up my friends in Italy, and I said, I read it twice, and I called him, and I talked to him about our research, and
yeah.
He wasn't very encouraging, but I called my friends in Italy, and I said, could we be so lucky to have still the material from the rats, from the controls that never received this injection because they're the control lots. And they said, oh, yes, we have everything. I said, well, look at the organs and see if there's any inflammation from just the wheat diet, from the modern wheat. And there was. Hmm. So we were confirming what Dr. Davis was saying. But the new and exciting finding was that the ancient wheat produced anti-inflammatory responses to even protect the system against inflammation.
Right. That's really interesting. I'm fascinated by it. You know, I've heard a lot of people in the health world talk about the difference between modern wheat and like that the gluten molecule might be different, and that's why so many people have gluten intolerance. Mm-hmm. And it's like the way that the wheat has been bred, not
yes.
wheat in general. But I haven't seen a lot of science, so this is really fascinating.
Well, we now have 31 papers published, and we have about 15 more somewhere in the pipeline. So we're going to get close to 50 in this whole experiment. And these are published with high-class, reputable journals, all peer-reviewed scientific journals, well-known throughout the world, and they all have the same results. We went from the small animal study then to human clinical trials. And we immediately went to chronic disease because we know chronic disease is linked to inflammation, and they sort of play on each other.
Right.
And we did double-blind studies that people didn't know what they were eating. They did crossover studies so that people ate one diet for eight weeks and then had a washout period and then flipped over and ate the other diet for 8 weeks. And then they did blood tests and all kinds of other analysis depending on what kind of group you're studying. We did heart disease, irritable bowel syndrome, diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome, and now we're just finishing a study on fibromyalgia.
Wow.
And it's all showing the same thing, that the biggest difference is the inflammatory difference between modern wheat and anti-inflammatory difference between ancient wheat, and it's 30 to 50% difference. And the rest of the differences are like 8 to 12%. They're still significant and measurable. Like lowering of cholesterol, lowering of blood sugar, lowering of insulin, lowering of insulin resistance, increasing of magnesium and zinc in the blood, and calcium. So it's a very big difference that a very small kernel of grain is making in your diet.
Right. Fascinating.
I want to
talk more about the potential, the unique qualities in terms of how Kamut grows and sustainability as well. We have to take a short break first. So we're going to take a quick break for a word from a sponsor. And then when we come back, we'll have more with Bob Quinn.
This episode is brought to you by Café Patachou. Long described as a student union for adults, Café Patachou is an award-winning café serving world-class breakfast and lunch in the heart of Indianapolis. Created by Martha Hoover, Café Patachou began as a mission to open a restaurant that used the best local ingredients prepared expertly. What Martha would cook for her own family was exactly what she wanted for her restaurant guests. Café Patachou has since grown into a restaurant group and the Patachou Foundation. And while Martha is no longer in the kitchen whisking 3 eggs per omelet anymore, she is still spreading her passion for premium local ingredients, now in several concepts and locations. Learn more at patachouinc.com. That's PATACHOU.com.
All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Bob Quinn, a farmer and author of the new book, Grain by Grain. So before the break, we were talking a lot about Kamut, this ancient wheat that you're growing. And we started to talk a little bit about some of the studies that you've been doing on potential health benefits. I know that as an organic farmer, you know, I've seen some of your blogging. I know you're also passionate about sustainability and how what you do impacts the environment and growing food that you know has a minimal impact. So how does Kamut fit into that? Like, is wheat a crop that has particular benefits in terms of an environmental perspective?
Well, I think the advantage with the Kubu Khorasan weed and any of the, particularly any of the heirloom type varieties of almost any crop, is that they haven't been bred solely to produce extremely high yields.
Mm.
And to get high yields, you need high inputs. With organic agriculture, that's not our goal, is to have high yields and high outputs, and therefore bring a lot of outside inputs onto the farm. Our goal is to, in regenerative organic agriculture at least, is to grow what we need right on the farm and to regenerate the soil in a way that can go on for eons.
Mm-hmm.
And without running out of any resource, because we're recreating those resources every year through the power of the sun and the power of the plants to feed the soil.
Right.
And the lower yielding crops lend themselves, like the Kubu Khorasan is, lend themselves easier to accomplishing those goals. And I think that's why it's a good fit.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. It's just really interesting to find someone who has spent so much of their career on like this one, like sort of like bringing this one crop to the world. Like that's really, it's cool.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. It wasn't, it's not my only focus and not the only focus of my book, but it's a main engine that was enabled us to drive through all the other research. It provided money for me to do the research we're talking about before the break. It provided money for me to continue experimenting on my farm, which experiments don't make you money, but they bring you a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much help to other people who are having the same problems and looking for answers. Particularly when we first started, there was no research for organic anything.
Yeah.
And if we wanted to figure out an answer to something, we just did it ourselves. We just did our own experiments. And then little by little, money became available. I became had good contacts with Montana State University and the experiment station nearby. And we worked together. And when they had grants, and we opened up our farm to experiments there by researchers from the university. And so I could actually leverage a lot of what I was doing many, many fold by having the scientists from Montana State come and be part of our research on our farm.
Right. Yeah. And so you've just brought up the book. You said, this wheat is not the only topic in the book. What made you decide to write a book? And so, it's not the only topic, it's part of the story, but what's the message? What did you want to get out into the world?
Well, that's why I decided to write a book, so I could tell my message.
Right.
Because I noticed that in many cases, people who wrote books were given audiences then to talk about their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, if that's the way it takes, that's what I'm going to do. And even though I'd never done it before, and I spent 5 years working on it before I joined up with a co-author, Liz Carlisle, who really was able to do in 5 months what I couldn't do in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And brought it to fruition, and I'm really excited about it. I really want to share what I have seen and learned as an alternative to the quandary that we find ourselves in industrial agriculture in this country and industrial food production, which I think is bringing many unintended consequences that are quite severe to our society and to our country and even to the planet.
Yeah. So can you give me an example of like something that you've learned that that you elaborate on in the book?
Sure. I can. I like to talk about the high cost of cheap food.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask you about that. It's one of my favorite topics, so it's perfect.
So anyway, to me, the high cost of cheap food starts first with the high cost of the farmers, because in the conventional industrial model, the farmers aren't paid enough to hardly even make a living, and the cost of chemical inputs is driving some of them out of business in times when the prices go down, which they are right now. Prices are quite depressed in the grain belt, and yet the cost of chemicals aren't depressed. And so how are you going to make up the difference? Some, if they're too close to the edge of liquidity on their farm, they can't make up the difference, and they have to sell, or they have to leave, or they go out of business. I think that's a very high cost to the farmers to start with, because they're not receiving a fair return for what they are doing and their efforts that they're putting into their farm. And yet they're producing abundance of cheap grain to feed the cheap food drive or goal in this country. The next segment to really suffer for paying the high cost of cheap food is the communities that those farmers used to serve and to use, where they used to shop and do business, and where their kids used to go to school. And when they disappear, it puts the strain on Main Street and small towns, so that they start going out of business. Many businesses can't survive the loss of clientele, which further strains the schools, and the schools go down small enough, they start to close, and it's just a domino effect. So it's really going the wrong direction for what we want to do in keeping our rural parts of this country, which are quite a large, vast segment of the country, viable and healthy. The next cost that we pay is the cost to our environment and to our planet. We have now glyphosate in the rain. I suppose you, Lisa, or maybe your listeners saw the articles that I saw yesterday in USA Today about now finding glyphosate in wine and beer throughout the country.
Interesting.
And so it's more and more, as we look, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And we even find glyphosate in the rainwater that falls on our farm, which is a big shock. About 3 years ago, we discovered this. And it's a case where a chemical was promised to be benign, to stay where it was put, to do its job without any harm. And none of that's true.
Yeah.
And none of that's true. And we have to look at alternatives to that. I think that we are nearing the end of the great chemical experiment that we've been on the last 70 years. And the sooner we can revitalize the soil and depend on that for our crop nutrition and nourishing our bodies and the bodies of those that eat our food, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an interesting topic. And I think... So this idea that there are these costs, and when food is cheap, it's cheap because we are all sort of paying for it just in different ways,
that's
right?
And the last big subject, if there's four, and the last big one is the cost to our health.
Right.
So people have seen in this country from 1941 to today, the cost of their food has decreased 60%. So what do you suppose they've done with all that money that they saved? I'll give you one idea where most of it's gone. The cost of health care has increased by 60%.
Right.
So almost everything we've saved in the cost of cheap food is now going to pay for mostly chronic disease and other maladies that are having to be paid for at not at the checkout counter at the grocery store, but at the doctor's office, at the pharmacy, and in the hospitals, and nursing homes, in the tune that completely obliterates all those savings for cheap food.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because people, I think when you talk to the people about this, they inherently get it. But then I have such trouble kind of like explaining this in a way that kind of is able to go up against the idea that people are just used to paying food being cheap, right?
Right.
And so then still, you get to the grocery store and they still want to buy the cheap thing. And I guess, when you talk to people about this, do you find that people respond to it, and that you think that they might change their purchasing habits based on? Because I don't. It's
that's
tricky.
Why I wrote a book. And I don't go to the grocery store with them, so I don't know what the effect is.
Right.
But I would hope, you know, that it would make a difference. But what we need is, I think, a little more of a constant reminder. You know, if we had a little label on every food that we bought giving us an index of nutrition, for example, and the cost of that nutrition, then the cheap food wouldn't look so cheap, because you could buy this loaf of bread for maybe $4, but it would last your family a lot longer because you don't need to eat as much because it's so full of nutrition. Or you could buy the $1.98 one that you have to eat twice as much to keep full, and there's no nutrition there, well, very little, compared to the more expensive nutrition, rich loaf of bread, for example. I mean, that's just a kind of an example out of the air. But if we had a way of thinking that reminded us of what we were actually investing in, people say, "Oh, gosh, I don't have any money," but it costs a lot of money to buy more expensive. To spend more money at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
I say to them, well, how much does it cost to be sick?
Yeah.
It costs way more to be sick. But since you're not sick today, people don't think about that. But people who have loved ones or good friends who are sick today, some of those people really think about it a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and you know, a lot of times then you get pushback where people say, well, a lot of people just still can't afford to pay more. And I think there are a lot of people in a lot of communities that can't. But that's an issue with wages, right?
That's one problem is wages not being fair, and particularly in the food sector. If you look at minimum wage and low-paying jobs, the food sector has more than their share.
Yeah.
But if you're in that situation, here's some ideas of what you can do.
Great.
When you go to the store, don't buy the frozen entrees that cost 20 times what the raw material would cost. With our grain, for example, you could buy that at the store for $1 to $1. It's expensive. But if you buy this grain and take that home and crack it and cook it up for hot cereal for breakfast, like you would on a winter day, like we're in the middle of now, you could feed a family of four for less than 50 cents.
Hmm.
Now, you can't tell me that's expensive. That's not expensive.
No.
But it's a way of eating and a way of thinking, and it takes 10 minutes to prepare. I mean, I do it in my kitchen once or twice a week. I have hot cereal, and it takes 10 minutes to fix and to enjoy. And it's great. I love it. And but if people would get in the habit of eating more, certainly more local, more seasonal, growing, if they have any kind of a garden spot or even a place to put a planter in their porch, trying to grow a few of their own vegetables or things that they would eat, all those things go a long way in buying basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then spending a little time cooking. Make that fun. Don't look at cooking as a chore. Make it a social opportunity with your spouse, with your kids, with whatever. And make it fun. Don't make it a drudgery. I know that's easier said than done. But for me, it's fun. Especially if I'm taking something I've grown out of my garden or I have in my root cellar and I bring it in the house and I make something out of it. And it takes 15 or 20 minutes sometimes. But I have great satisfaction with that.
Mm. What you mentioned kamut, like you can make it like a hot cereal, like an oatmeal So what other, like I haven't seen it in that many other forms. Like how is it available to people?
Well, it's available in any way you want to eat wheat, you can find kamut.
Okay.
It's not as available in this country as it is in Italy, which is our biggest market in the recent past. But you can find it in breads, all kinds of bread products.
Mm.
Here in New York, Susie's makes a great flatbread. You can find it in pastas, so it's really close relative to Durham, as I mentioned earlier.
Mm.
So it's easy to make pasta with it. Eden Foods makes great pasta. They're found in your health food stores. Bob's Red Mill has it as grain, flour, and hot cereal already ground for you if you like to just buy it ready to eat. And they're found all over the country. There's sprouted kamut coming out of a customer in Alabama.
Mm.
So you can have sprouted flours if you want. And there are some snacks and other pizzas. Sometimes in California, there's a pizza truck that's using just kamut. It's fabulous, and people who can't eat modern wheat pizza, you know, love that sort of thing. But anyway, it's available at their health food stores. If you don't see it, you can ask for it. If they carry a brand you recognize, like Eden Foods or Bob Red Mill, they can get it without too much trouble. But sometimes it's because people don't know about it as much as we'd like, I guess.
Yeah.
And the stores haven't all carried it because people haven't asked for it. Nature's Path is probably our biggest single customer. They make Heritage cold cereal, and it's mostly kamut in it. It doesn't say kamut on the front, but it says kamut on the back, so you can look and see what the ingredients are. So it's available in all the main types of foods that you would eat that have wheat.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'm going to look for it more now.
All right,
for
great.
Sure.
I hope you enjoy it. It's great.
And so we have to wrap up, unfortunately. But before we do that, where can people find your book, if they want to follow up and find out more?
Well, thanks, Lisa. That's a great question. The book is going to be released on the 5th day of March, which is just right around the corner now. And once that date passes, you can get it at your local bookstore, at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com. As far as information, you can hashtag me at Grain by Grain. Welcome to join that anytime, those conversations, and also look at my blog and the other social media accounts on Instagram at Bob Quinn Organic Farmer.
I love that you're so active. You know, you're farming, you got a book, and you're on Instagram.
Well,
you got a lot going on.
I've leased out my farm. It was time for the next generation to take over. I had my turn. Now it's their turn. So I am trying to wind a few things down as I ramp up a few other things. So I'm trying to keep a little balance in my life.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Lisa. It's great.
Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate, and share it. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.